KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
With the coal train coming through that they're wanting to do, it's just another product.
So it really got to a point where I said to myself, if I want to pursue the ideas that I want to pursue, I think I have to do it myself. I don't see where I can fit myself into something that's already up and running.
And over a period of time, they can have a legalized status that allows them to live a life of dignity, but not necessarily a path to citizenship.
That's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush changing his views on a path to citizenship on immigration. For that, we heard Jess Van Nostrand, founder of Seattle's The Project Room, and Rich Burkholder sharing his thoughts about coal trains moving through his backyard. Good morning. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve shares off this week. The National Transportation Safety Board issued an interim report on the cause of a battery fire in Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Meanwhile, the Federal Aviation Administration is close to approving Boeing's plans to fix those batteries. Joining me to talk more about what's going on is Guy Norris, senior editor of Aviation Week, joining us from Las Vegas. Hello, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Hello.
What did you learn from the NTSB report issued this morning?
Well, at the moment, it's a huge, huge report. It's over 500 pages long, and it's so densely packed with information and a review of the entire investigation that it's actually almost impossible to give you a summary at the moment. The website that obviously that people have been downloading the report from has been so busy that it seems to have crashed in the last hour. So. Ask me later on that one.
I will, Guy. Interim reports indicate that they have not yet come up with a definitive cause for a fire in January. And I was wondering if you could walk us back to the initial reason that the 787s were grounded.
Right. Well, in early January, an initial incident occurred at Boston Airport on January the 7th when a Japanese Airlines 787 was on the ground having just arrived in from Japan, and a battery fire began in the aft EE bay, which is the electronic bay where the where it was located. Then, of course, a week later, a second event occurred actually in the air with an ANA aircraft in Japan itself, forcing that aircraft to divert. So the two events prompted the FAA eventually to order U.S. registered aircraft to be grounded, followed, of course, by a grounding of the world's fleet by that stage, which then at that time numbered about 50 operational aircraft.
Now, as I understand it, if there has not yet the specific cause of these battery fires has not been pinpointed, how has it been that Boeing has gone ahead trying to work on a fix?
Well, Boeing's approach all along on this has been to essentially, its approach is to mitigate the effects of a fire or at least a battery malfunction. So they've decided they've stuck with their technology of lithium-ion battery technology, and have they decided that they could contain anything that might happen. And their idea is that they can statistically prove really that the events that took place, if they can mitigate those in the future, then they can have a safe system. So that the FAA's quandary at the moment is to whether to allow this sort of mitigation approach to be used. And at the moment, that's what we're waiting on now, to see if the FAA is going to allow Boeing to flight test that redesigned system. So it's also interesting, the NTSB recently, in the last hour, has also called for or announced plans for a forum and a hearing which will actually look at the whole process that was used to certify and design the battery. So there's a lot of moving. It's a sort of moving parts of the chess game right now. We still really can't see how that's going to be resolved.
We're talking with Guy Norris, senior editor of Aviation Week, who joins us from Las Vegas. The National Transportation Safety Board this morning issued a massive report, an interim report, as I understand it, and people who maybe had better luck downloading that report before the website crashed indicate that they haven't yet specified the exact cause. In the meantime, the FAA, there are some reports that the FAA may give approval for Boeing to test its fixes as early as next week. And as you just mentioned, Guy, the latest little bug thrown into the whole thing is that the NTSB is going to look into the FAA's initial approval. It sounds like a circus.
Well, it's certainly something that we've never seen before, and the issue here is that really you're dealing with a sort of an advanced technology, if you like, that certainly some of the regulators appear to have become uncomfortable with, but only in hindsight, having originally certified this several years ago now. It's sort of this is a situation which has never happened before that I'm aware of in the history of federal regulations with air transport.
And meanwhile, the current Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, has told the Wall Street Journal, for one, that he wants to proceed with extreme caution. So even should the FAA give Boeing the go-ahead to test, it sounds like the company will be scrutinized in a way that it wasn't 5 or 6 years ago.
Right, exactly, and I think the main focus now, as far as Boeing is concerned, is to try and get going with those, at least with those initial flight tests, as soon as it can, because the more information they have and the more hard facts that they can present to the FAA, the sooner they'll know if there's a resolution in sight. And they're itching to get going with this because right now, as we speak, they're doing ground testing of their fix. They've in all of the laboratories in the Seattle area, so they're poised to do this as soon as they get that call from Mr. LaHood.
And you mentioned flight tests, and we were talking about this in the newsroom. They put the new battery with its fix in, and they send it up in the air. I mean, how do you actually test this?
Yes, that's right. They remember that a few weeks ago they were able to get some data from flights of the existing battery system, and during those flights they essentially covered a matrix of conditions where they would be powering the battery up and down, and as well as monitoring the condition of the environment that the battery sees as the aircraft climbs and descends and goes through various accelerations and decelerations. So that's sort of what would happen with this. They would begin a slow build-up process where they would just take the aircraft through routine flights and then transition the power demands in and out of the battery system. So they would essentially check out the battery throughout the entire flight environment. And that's really essentially what they would begin to do with the start of a certification program.
So while Boeing is focused on the lithium-ion battery, we hear reports out of Japan that the aviation workers union there has some concerns about circuit boards, three circuit boards that caught fire. Are the circuit boards and the batteries connected? Well, obviously they're connected at some point, but are the problems connected?
We don't think they are, actually. Essentially, they are two, although, as you quite rightly say, they are parts of both elements of the electrical system. Early on, Boeing was quite clear when it was facing those initial areas of sort of the teething troubles, if you like, of the initial operational flights. And they were very clear to state that these weren't, in fact, related at all to the battery issue. So well, what's happened is anything that's still, of course, electrically related, is a newsworthy event. But to be honest, it's a different set of issues there.
Something else for Boeing to be concerned about. Finally, and this is a few years, obviously, down the line, or maybe not. I wonder how Boeing, once they get a go ahead for whatever fix they have come up with, once they've tested it, once they feel comfortable, how are you going to get airlines and passengers feeling okay about going back onto a Dreamliner?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, at the moment, the last thing I think that they're probably thinking about is, you know, the sort of a new PR campaign to get people to love the Dreamliner again. But inevitably, I think the airlines and Boeing will have to face that. And it's something that, in a way, they'll be welcoming that challenge, because at the moment, just getting the airplane back into service is everybody's main priority.
Well, we may contact you again once you've waded through the 600 pages of the NTSB report. Thank you so much for joining us, Guy.
You're very welcome.
Guy Norris is senior editor of Aviation Week, joining us from Las Vegas. And as I mentioned, the National Transportation Safety Board issued an interim report on the cause of the lithium-ion battery fire in Boeing 787 Dreamliner, and that was just issued about an hour ago. So we'll wade through it, and we'll have more details through the day here on KUOW. And now it's time for Voices of Coal. All this week, EarthFix, our environmental news partners, are bringing us audio postcards of people who have a personal stake in the Northwest's proposals to build a coal export terminal.
I'm Richard Burkholder, and I'm one of the owners at Spinrail Dune Buggy.
Hi, my name is Tanya Burkholder. I'm also an owner here at Spinrail Dune Buggy, North Bend, Oregon, just south of Lakeside. Our house is right here next to our business, and the train tracks run probably 100 feet maybe behind our house, so we hear the train.
The train has been running through here since it was surveyed back in 1864. They've always had a commercial type of train coming through, whether it's logging, whether it's gravel, dirt. With the coal train coming through that they're wanting to do, it's just another product. We have over 60 miles of these dunes along the coast. We have a wide variety of wildlife. There's residential areas. There's play areas. They train Iditarod dogs here. They do all types of stuff in the dunes. A coal terminal is not going to affect tourism. We're still going to see the business. We're going to see the people coming through. It's not in a position where it's going to hurt the dunes. It's not in a position, I believe, where it's going to hurt the environment. And if it will impact our business as far as if the community grows and economically it's strong and sound, more people are going to come in here.
It's a tourism-driven community, really. I think it would be nice to have an additional revenue booster in this area. I am from Montrose, which is in western Colorado, right in the middle of a lot of coal, a lot, to me growing up there. It was just a part of life. There was a lot of people that my family knew that had jobs that were related to the coal industry. I saw coal trains a lot, but I really don't think there's a lot of negative about it. I think that there's probably more positive, and I think that having it here would be a positive thing for this community.
The terminal is going to provide jobs. It'll bring in ships. It brings in sailors on those ships who spend money in town. They walk the boardwalk. They go to the restaurants. You drive down through Coos Bay right now. Look at how many buildings are empty. Look at how many businesses that used to be there are empty. With a coal terminal, put aside the coal. It's business.
The Burkholders support the proposed coal terminals. We want to know what you think. You can email us weekday at kuow.org. And you can find a link to the entire series, Voices of Coal, at our website. That's kuow.org.
It's 9:18. During a presidential race, the early primary states get a lot of attention. But how important are they, really? We'll find out in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from All-Wheel Drive Auto, independent Subaru repair and maintenance on the east side. Appointment scheduling and information about all services offered is online at allwheeldriveauto.com, helping drivers get more from their Subarus.
46 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. It's been rainy this morning. Forecast calls for a chance of showers through the day and an afternoon high of 50. Then clouds overnight with a low of 38, and tomorrow Friday partly sunny in the morning,
then mostly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 51. The Project Room on Seattle's Capitol Hill is a nonprofit arts center that its founder says exists to explore ideas relevant to contemporary life. We'll learn more about the Project Room in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in This Week for Steve Scher. We've got at least a couple of years before serious campaigning for president starts again. I'm talking about serious campaigning. The jockeying has already begun. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush backtracked on his previous position on immigration. Bush was formerly in favor of creating a pathway to citizenship. This week, Jeb Bush said he doesn't favor that anymore. He wants to create a path to legal residency.
So we propose legalizing them. After there is a recognition that if people come here illegally, they have to pay a fine or do community service, make sure they don't commit any serious crimes, and over a period of time they can have a legalized status that allows them to live a life of dignity, but not necessarily a path to citizenship.
That's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who people believe is positioning himself for a run for president in 2016. Meanwhile, in his first interview since his defeat last year, Mitt Romney told Fox News about the biggest mistake, as he sees it, of his 2012 presidential campaign.
The weakness that our campaign had and that I had is we weren't effective in taking my message primarily to minority voters, to Hispanic Americans, African Americans, other minorities. That was a real weakness. We did very well with the majority population, but not with minority populations. And that was a failing. That was a real mistake.
That's Mitt Romney, who ran an unsuccessful presidential campaign last year. If you are thinking of making a run for U.S. president, David Domke has some advice for you. Today, he joins us with rule number 3 for winning the White House. And that's out of 5. Use early primary states to your advantage. David Domke, professor of communications at the University of Washington. Nice to see you again.
Good morning, Marcy.
Okay, so early primary states, are we talking about New Hampshire, Iowa, who?
Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. They're the 4 that are deemed by each of the major parties as carve-out states. They get to carve out of the rest of the primary schedule to go early, to go first. It's just an agreement that the parties have with those states based in tradition and also based in geographical balance.
Because I ask about which ones because it seems that everybody's been jockeying mm-hmm. to be earlier and earlier and earlier. But these states, these are preserved?
Yeah, they're preserved. What that means is they don't get penalized for going earlier. All of the rest of the 46 states, if they try to beat any of these 4 in the ordering, are penalized delegates, penalized seating, the kind of seats they get at the convention.
So these aren't big states population-wise. They don't have lots of delegates. They don't carry the clout that a California, say, right. does. So why is it advantageous to position yourself well there?
Well, there's a couple reasons. The first is that in pure strategic terms, if you don't win early, you don't win. Because you can lose... You can win early and lose later and still be okay because you've established yourself. And see, I can win. I can win somewhere. I can win, you know. But if you don't win early, then you don't ever usually get the chance to win later because the money doesn't flow your way. The press coverage doesn't come to your attention. The volunteers on your campaign start going elsewhere because they're looking for a winner. So if you don't win early, you just don't win.
Well, what about if not winning but being really close? Because if I'm remembering 2008, and that was a while ago, President Obama and some of those early primaries maybe didn't win but managed to somehow be close or be visible or kind of rise above the field.
Well, he won in Iowa.
He won Iowa.
Yeah, and it was an upset because Hillary Clinton was the front runner there. And so that was, in fact, I'm doing this lecture series for Seattle Arts and Lectures and the Alumni Association, the UW, and tonight's the 3rd installment at Kane Hall, 7:30. And the argument I'll be making tonight is that Barack Obama had about a 1 in 100 chance to win the Democratic nomination, and that it was all entirely contingent upon winning in Iowa. Because Hillary Clinton was such a massive front runner, had all of the support behind her, that if he didn't win there, he wasn't going to probably win anywhere. So he did win there. And in fact, if you look at the last several presidents from Jimmy Carter forward, which is really the modern primary era coming out of the 1968 Democratic convention debacle and the 72 reforms that were created, every candidate who's become president has won in Iowa or New Hampshire.
These races go back and forth. So you talk about media coverage, you talk about donors, which seems to be the money seems to be primary, no pun intended, but that you really need to be raising massive amounts of money to do this. So having that visibility, bringing yourself up from 1 in 100 to 50-50 or whatever you would have put his odds, Barack Obama's odds in 2007 and after Iowa, that unlocks the wallets and that gives you what you need?
It is a reality that in David Plouffe's book, The Audacity to Win, Plouffe was the Obama campaign manager. He talks about how much money poured in within 24 hours after winning Iowa. And then even Obama narrowly lost to Clinton in New Hampshire. And both of those campaigns got a huge influx of money afterwards because they were both seen as viable, right? So if you've won early and he won the first one, and then you can lose in New Hampshire and you're still okay because you've shown you can win somewhere.
Let's talk about the Republicans in 2012, you know, that seemed like we had a wide field when we started off the year of campaigning and that it was flipping from primary to primary. We'd see somebody emerge as the anointed king. I've won my primary. And then they'd be picked off at that next one. Are you saying that had they built up a real head of steam very early on, they would have been unstoppable?
Yeah, The fact is that it was a muddled situation in 2012 for the Republicans because Mitt Romney was called the winner of Iowa by a handful of votes, 9, I think, in the first night. Then about 3 weeks later, Rick Santorum was called the winner.
Right.
And then Romney went off to win, and he did win in New Hampshire, but then in South Carolina, Newt Gingrich won. So nobody established themselves across those three. That's the first time in the modern primary system when there's been three different winners of the first three primaries. And I would also say that hurt Mitt Romney tremendously going into the throughout the primaries, that he had to shake off Rick Santorum, who did not have much money, didn't even have a pollster on his campaign. So if Mitt Romney had been able to win convincingly in Iowa, then he would have coasted along. And he just wasn't able to. You don't get to unite the party in a way you need to unite the party if you're divided in that capacity.
So it sounds like if we're talking about lesson number three of the road to the 2016 presidential victory, that a third party candidate has very, very slim hopes. They're not 1 in 100. They're maybe 1 in 1,000.
Well, if you're talking about
coming in to win these things and make it to the top,
a third party outside the Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, somebody else.
It'd be very difficult in this day and age for that to happen. However, I am intrigued in 2016 about a possible pairing that I think could emerge. I do think Chris Christie and John Huntsman could end up teaming up because Christie is very popular with independents and Democrats, but not as much with the base of the Republican Party. Same with John Huntsman. I don't know if either one of, I know Huntsman can't, and I don't think Christie can win the nomination for the Republicans, but they both are very ambitious men. So I think that they're possible. But in general, it's very difficult because you need to go through the delegates, through the process. The media coverage focuses on those parties and those candidates.
Well, you are a professor of communications. You work with a lot of students. You've taken them to the conventions themselves that followed this. And when you talk about media coverage, it just sparks in my mind what our responsibility as the media is to maybe look at these things a different way. I mean, if we follow in the system that as it's been established and we anoint the victor of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, the front runner, what are we doing to the other candidates or maybe even before the primary? Should we be looking at it a different way?
Of course. Absolutely.
Okay.
There's all kinds of different ways the primaries themselves could be organized. They could be geographically rotating around the country. Huh. Which states get to go first could be randomly plucked, things like this. But that's on the political side. On the news side of this, how it gets covered, it would be really great if there was an approach by journalists to not cover this as a game, but to instead to cover it as a debate. And in debates, sometimes the best ideas don't crystallize till later on in the process. And you cover it by a game, what you cover it as which is the way politics gets covered by most of the mainstream media. What you do is you cover who's ahead, mm-hmm. who just made the best strategic move. And in that respect, if a team, quote unquote team, is down by 20 after the first quarter, and the first quarter is New Hampshire and Iowa, then you know, the news cover starts to talk about how, well, you know, this game's probably over. And so those candidates that are quite influential, I mean, like Ron Paul was quite influential but got very little coverage.
Right.
And he just kind of just got left out of this, out of the debate, the news conversation after the first couple primaries. But he was actually very important in the Republican process and has laid the groundwork for his son, I think, in many ways.
We're talking with University of Washington Communications Professor David Domke. And as he mentioned, he's giving a series of lectures called Winning the White House in 2016. We're on rule number 3 of his 5 rules on that path. You talked about a debate, talking about issues. And before I introduced you, we played a clip from former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who is the one Bush son that they thought was going to run for president before George W. ran for president. He was sort of the anointed heir to his father's presidency. But you got me to thinking about Chris Christie as well, the positioning that does go on. We're not really seeing a campaign yet, but we are seeing a lot of these mostly guys at this point laying some kind of groundwork, right, on issues.
Absolutely. Jeb Bush is he's one of those quote-unquote serious candidates in that he doesn't really want a campaign per se. He wants to just have big ideas. And that's kind of how Newt Gingrich is. He likes to have big ideas but doesn't really want to do the hard, dirty work of campaigning, the calling everybody to raise money. And so I think what happened with Bush is that he's been a serious, big idea person and has been really the only mainstream Republican who has been relatively pro-immigration. Okay, John McCain used to be, but backed away from it.
Right.
Then what happened was after the 2012 election, other Republicans, including Marco Rubio and then John McCain and Lindsey Graham, all got back on that pro-immigration bandwagon. And so did many Republicans, by the way, nationally. And Jeb Bush suddenly was kind of tossed to the side in this because he doesn't hold office.
Right.
He doesn't have any substantive position. And I think that he began to see the rising star of Marco Rubio, which is his protege in Florida. He Rubio was the person that Bush kind of brought up from the grassroots. And so I think that Bush, in this latest maneuver, has partly wanted to get back in the spotlight and partly also slightly outflanked Rubio with the conservative base of the party by saying, okay, I'm not going to be hostile to immigrants, which was what Romney was perceived as, but I'm not going to give them citizenship. And that definitely is to the conservative side of Marco Rubio. And I think it's hurting him now, Bush, but it could play well in places like Iowa and New Hampshire and,
well,
South Carolina.
You mentioned earlier the other Democrat who has been in the news for probably what the base of the conservative wing of the Republican Party hates to think of. Chris Christie, after the Superstorm Sandy, I think a lot of people in the base thought of him as sort of a traitor to his party, right? And
yeah.
So now, most recently, he decided that he was going to accept the stipulations that come with federal Medicaid dollars. Another thing that a lot of the conservative base is upset about, and a lot of governors have refused, Republican governors have refused that money. So what is he doing right now?
Well, so if you look at Iowa and New Hampshire, and if my argument is you have to win early,
right,
then you have to win one of those two states. And they have very distinct, different Republican profiles in their who votes in those states. In Iowa, it's quite conservative social issues. In New Hampshire, it's quite conservative economic and fiscal issues. Christie has no chance in Iowa.
Really?
Oh, no.
You're going to say that right off the
bat. Yeah, he has no chance in Iowa. He's not a social conservative. He has a great chance in New Hampshire. He's seen as fiscally quite conservative and a reasonable New Englander kind of person. So I think that Christie is very well positioned for New Hampshire. In fact, he's probably the front runner for the New Hampshire kind of line to the Republican nomination. And so I think that he doesn't really need to worry that much right now about the social conservative base of the party if he could go through New Hampshire and pick off enough of fiscal conservatives.
What you're talking about right now points out, I think, bigger discussions, is a mild word, that are taking place in the Republican Party, that there are two very, at least, distinct wings. I think the Democrats are more muddled at this point than the Republicans. We see this very strong push for these social issues, as you mentioned. And yet we're seeing Chris Christie, I think he's pretty popular in his state of New Jersey, which has a bunch of Democrats representing it on the federal level. So here's this man who kind of falls in some different camp and does represent a wing of the party that hasn't been in the spotlight heretofore.
Absolutely. I think he's remarkable in how much support he has in a Democratic state for a Republican governor. In fact, it's unprecedented. No Republican governor's ever had the kind of his approval ratings in New Jersey. So I think that he has a great chance through the fiscal wing of the Republican Party. If that doesn't happen, then I do think that he's a serious independent candidate. His approval ratings nationally are more positive with Democrats than with Republicans right now.
Well, there's still 3 years to go.
That's a short amount of time, Marcy.
I know, but should we get at least 6 months a break from the presidential campaigns? David Domke is a professor, acting chair of the University of Washington's Department of Communications. He's at the midpoint of his lecture series, Winning the White House in 2016, Five Rules for the Road. He's going to speak on rule number three tonight at 7:30.
I
had 7 o'clock.
No, tonight's the one lecture. It's at 7:30.
Okay, 7:30, room 130. Kane Hall on the University of Washington campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
:36. Correspondent Anna King brings us the latest news from Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Every day, KUOW brings you news and information that reflects our world and keeps you connected. But we can't do it without you. It's your financial support that makes it all possible. You may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at kuow.org. Your support right now will help keep our upcoming spring membership drive on target so we can get you back to regular programming sooner. Thanks for your generosity. :46 degrees in Seattle with a predicted high today of 50. Forecast calls for a chance of showers through the day. Clouds overnight, low of 38. Tomorrow, Friday, partly sunny in the morning, then mostly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 51.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture, proud supporters of the Seattle Symphony. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
The UN Security Council today voted unanimously for tough new sanctions to punish North Korea for its latest nuclear test. So now North Korea is threatening the United States with a preemptive nuclear strike. We'll have more on that in the news at 10.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scherer. Washington Governor Inslee went to Hanford yesterday. The governor was briefed on the status of the 6 leaking waste storage tanks there, also plans to move that waste. Our Richland correspondent Anna King was on hand, and she's with us today. Hi, Anna.
Good morning.
There is a great picture in the Seattle Times this morning of Governor Inslee walking through a field of pipes that sort of came up to his shins, and it got me to wondering, he's touring. What exactly could he see?
Well, that's a little hard to say, only because we couldn't go on a lot of the parts of the tour with Governor Inslee. We were constricted to kind of media corrals. They were fenced off areas, and we were trying to lean over the fence and get photos. And we're also trying to kind of see what we could do to see where he was going. But it was a little bit difficult. But that said, he did tour the Hanford's waste treatment plant, which is a massive factory that is about a $12 billion price tag that is supposed to stabilize this waste in glass logs that would come out the other side of the plant and keep it in a waste form that wouldn't go into the river, that would be somewhere you could put it in a mountain and it would be okay.
But that plant is not ready to be glassifying the waste yet, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, even if all things went according to plan and everything was great, it would start up in 2019 with testing and then kind of move into the actual hot waste. But that would take some order of years. And there's been a lot of questions with that plant lately. We've heard a lot of whistleblowers, top engineers have quit the project and have given memos to the Secretary of Energy stating that they have serious concerns with a lot of the basic science of this plant.
Well, some of the Department of Energy officials were on hand with the governor yesterday, I know, and according to the Associated Press reports that I saw, they weren't talking about gasification so much as they were talking about shipping waste away to New Mexico. Was that a long-distance pipe dream, or are they talking about moving up a timetable for that?
According to the Department of Energy officials that were on the media bus yesterday that I was questioning, they said this is something that has always been in the plans, that they have always thought that they might ship some of this waste down to New Mexico, but they are trying to see if they can shorten the time frame. It wouldn't necessarily start sooner, but it would move up the timeline on the back end and get the waste out of there a little bit quicker. The problem being that they need permits, they need the sign-off of the people of New Mexico, they need the senators behind them, whoever's in office at the time, and that's just a lot of complications to get this waste out of leaking tanks. And again, Marcy, they are leaking 3 gallons of waste per day in some order of that.
Well, the governor told reporters that at this point, we haven't seen the waste seeping into the groundwater. But should that happen, there is a system in place to remediate that. Is that true?
That's true. Actually, yesterday we drove by one of the water treatment plants out at the Hanford site. It's a new facility. It was completed last year, and it's massive. It looks like a Seattle downtown building almost,
wow.
But it's churning through water at some incredible rates, and they are pumping that water back into the ground to push the water towards the plant and draw more contaminated water back up. And it's pretty impressive. But that being said, you know, there have been questions by those who watch the site closely. Can you get all of the water? You know, if just a little bit of this waste hits the river, I don't think anybody wants that to happen. And they are saying that that is many, many years off in the distance if that were to ever happen. And they have a lot of smart scientists on this problem. But it is, you know, I think everybody's concerned about that. There's huge agriculture around this area. It's a tourism area. Nobody wants to see that waste move anywhere off the site.
And last question has to do with sequester. When we spoke last week, we had no idea, first, if the sequester would take effect, and second, what that would mean for the Hanford cleanup efforts. I saw a number, $91 million as the potential figure for cuts to river cleanup. What do we know about how budget cuts might affect Hanford?
Yeah, it would be a total of $182 million in cleanup work that would have to be cut at the site. You know, there's a lot of work out here, and so that is a portion of the work that would be done. But any slowdown out here is a big concern. And everybody is afraid that if you cut, you know, a worker and he can't provide or she can't provide for their family, maybe those skilled workers might go away and not come back to the site when there is money, and you'd have to retrain workers. And so it kind of has this cascading effect if you slow down work at the Hanford site. These are highly trained people. They have to go through all kinds of safety briefings and safety classes, sometimes for months to do the jobs they do. And if you lay one off and they move to Idaho or something, that just slows work down. And that would be about 4,800 workers that would be affected in possible layoffs or furloughs. And so that's a big impact out here when there's these huge problems that people are saying we need to do more work, not less out here.
Well, Anna, thanks so much for taking time to join us this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Anna King is KUOW's Richland correspondent. She covered Governor Jay Inslee's visit to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation yesterday. Governor Inslee is going to be the guest on The Conversation starting at noon today here on KUOW. It is Thursday time for our regular Art of Our City. When you walk by a place called the Project Room on Seattle's Capitol Hill, you could mistake this little storefront for one of the trendy galleries or boutiques that line the Pike Pine neighborhood streets, but you would be wrong. Founder Jess Van Nostrand opened the Project Room in July 2011. It's a place where she wanted to gather people to think about big philosophical questions and issues. Most recently, Jess Van Nostrand helped collect oral history that form the basis of the musical show These Streets, the chronicle of the women in grunge, which is on stage now at ACT Theater. I went to visit Jess Van Nostrand to find out what the student of art history and art curator had in mind when she started this project.
I had spent probably several years in several journals writing and thinking and using my own experience as an art curator to think about where I actually wanted to head with my career and with my ideas. So it really got to a point where I said to myself, if I want to pursue the ideas that I want to pursue, I think I have to do it myself. I don't see where I can fit myself into something that's already up and running. So it sort of became one of those situations where I thought, I have no other choice but to get this thing going. And that actually kicked off the very first big question, which was, why do we make things?
So if you were going to describe the Project Room, my editor asked me, you know, what is the Project Room? And I thought, I don't have a succinct definition. Do you now?
I'm working on it. It's evolving, and that's part of what I love about it, is that I opened the space while I was still figuring it out. The idea was to parallel the works in progress that we're showing here and to show what it's like to start an art space and open it up to the public, perhaps before it's all polished. So going through that experience has been really necessary to formulate what its mission really is. If I were to describe it today, I would say that it's a nonprofit art center that explores ideas that are relevant to contemporary life, and that it's an investigation into how creativity works by making it as inclusive and proving its relevance as much as possible.
So it's a place, actually, where we can come, because you pose big questions, themes. Hugo House does this to some extent as well, and then you have face-to-face conversations, you have artists explore those ideas, you address them on many different levels.
Exactly. The idea is to put out a question and to solicit as many different points of view as possible. So in order to do that, I spend a lot of time researching the most fascinating, interesting makers of things, whether or not they're in or outside of the arts, as we think of the arts, and to ask them to come share their point of view. Through that, then, I'm able to sort of guide a conversation and come away with some new information and some new ideas that I didn't have before.
Somebody who was writing about the Project Room, or maybe just writing about you, compared this a bit to Gertrude Stein and her salons of Paris in the early 20th century, that sort of jazz age of there. And there is some truth to that, because you're more a curator of people and ideas than you're not a curator in the sense that there's that Chiyo Ishikawa is a curator at the Seattle Art Museum.
That's true. First of all, that's the most awesome compliment ever to be compared to Gertrude Stein. I am a big fan of her legacy. She's been a big point of inspiration, definitely. Also in that she herself was not an artist, but cared a lot about the things that artists were making. And I think one of the things that interests me is getting away from the way that I was a visual art curator and trying to push some boundaries and think about what else that could be and how else I can exercise those ideas.
Right now, you and I are sitting and we're surrounded by posters from music. So, and they are visual, they're ads, they're visual ads, but they're their own visual art form for sure. But they're an extension of an oral art form, music. And I wonder, in 2013, as we sit and talk, if there are those boundaries at all, or if that's that is just a totally antiquated way of looking at art.
I'm more interested in the ideas behind the thing itself. I'm becoming less and less interested in the medium and the materials. And I wouldn't go so far as to predict that that is where things are going, but I think that's where my interests are. And I'm finding that there is an audience, a project room audience, that is responding to those ideas. And it just brings a certain kind of depth and perceptiveness to anything when you can look at a band poster and say, oh, this is about a lot more than design. There are other things going on here. It's telling us something else.
The other thing I think about is that this is a space where physically people come together in time to look at things, to talk about things, to listen to things, in an era where more and more we don't necessarily do that. We connect in that virtual world. And so it's an interesting dichotomy to me.
When I was first opening the organization, I did get asked by several people, why do you need to have a space? Why don't you just move around or be mobile or be online? It was always very important to me to have a gathering space. I'm trying to introduce different kinds of people to each other and to generate and to start relationships and to see what we can learn. However, there's a really strong duality between online programming and on-site programming. And I think that's what has to be in harmony. And that's what has been successful for us so far.
You are in the midst of Capitol Hill. It's not like you're off in somebody's garage, a storefront on Capitol Hill. You're a nonprofit. So how do you make this work financially?
Currently, the organization is supported completely by individual donations. So we have a group of supporters who are called the Founder Circle, and they have made a 3-year pledge. And that's something that I'm always working on, is to grow that group. And the idea is that then all programming can be free and open to the public as we continue to do this.
It is all free right now, yes?
So everything that takes place in the project room, regardless of partnerships, is free and open to the public. And I think that's really important, because part of the mission is being inclusive. And so the idea is that anyone can walk through the door, even if they didn't plan to, and have some kind of interesting encounter or experience.
I was reading an article that Regina Hackett wrote about you and a bunch of other curators almost 7 years ago, 2006 it was published, and something really struck me about that. What she was saying is that this is an arty city and the field is crowded for people of your generation who move here. That struck me, A. But B, more so than that, was the real entrepreneurial nature of Seattle creative thinkers. People come here for a lot of reasons. One of them is because you can invent new things in a way that you might not be able to in Amsterdam.
I definitely agree, and it's why I have stayed here as long as I have. I moved to Seattle as part of a cross-country drive, and it seemed like a neat place to check out. But the fact that I've stayed here 10 years is a testament to the support that I've found in the grassroots, very supportive, I don't know, alternative, whatever you want to call it, that from the week that I set foot in Seattle, I found something to get involved with. And I love that Seattle is a place where you can try new things and take a chance.
So we're sitting in the back and we're surrounded by these posters. And this These Streets project came out of the heads of Sarah Rudinoff and Greta Harley. But your involvement at the project room seems like it started pretty early on, yes?
It was about a year ago that Greta approached me and asked if I would be interested in hosting some memorabilia or some materials related to the show to extend the reach of These Streets. And my response was, well, let's do something much, much bigger. Let's really create an experience that tells the story of that time and gives people something else to grab onto as they're learning about these stories. And the oral history interview program ended up being largely filmed at the project room with me as the interviewer. And that's been a large part of my education here, is being able to speak one-on-one with these musicians I didn't know before and ask some really big questions that connect to the way the project room is structured.
So what sorts of things did you learn that really do connect to the sorts of questions that you have, big questions you have about creativity?
There's a lot of talk about what inspires artists or where they get their ideas from, and we talk about that a lot at the Project Room. So it's very informative to sit down across from a musician who's been through a lot of different experiences and is now maybe looking back. She's maybe in her late 40s and looking back and thinking, what have I accomplished? What do I still yet want to accomplish? And to ask her, what made you go down that path in particular, and how do you feel about maintaining your creativity? Does it get harder as you grow older? How do you feel about being in a really youth-dominated industry? And what is it like to be a mom and have young kids? Do you still rock out, and do your kids like that? All kinds of questions I would just come up with, and we had a great time sort of dissecting some of these life thoughts.
How long will this stay up here?
This is up through March 14th. What we'll be doing is having events every Thursday at 6 o'clock right before the show. So anyone who has tickets for a Thursday show can come to the Project Room first, mingle with some of the artists. Something will be happening, either a roundtable discussion or something like that. And then, you know, we can all go down to the theater together.
You said that you have three-year commitments from these founders. I'm jumping back to the Project Room. Right now, your failure is the big theme for this season, at least. And how far out do you think about questions? Do they come directly to you? Are these things that other people pose to you? Where do these questions come from?
Well, the big questions, which are 1 to 2 years in length, are basically the things that keep me up at night. These are the things that I think about, that I think I'd like to try and tackle. And then within the big questions, I identify what I call a topic. And the topics are like the chapters of the bigger book. And they bring some more focus to these big questions so that programming makes a little bit more sense and isn't just totally wildly abstract and hard to follow. So the topics then are only planned maybe 2 to 3 months out. The reason being that I would like each topic to inspire a following topic. And I would like to, I'm getting away from the museum structure of planning something 2 to 6 years out. And that was on my list of things that I wanted to change when I opened the Project Room in my own practice. So there's a level of immediacy that I get from these topics. And quite often, because this is a research project in a way, a certain topic will spawn, so to speak, a future topic. And I like to leave room for that to happen.
When you were in grad school some years ago, before you came here, were you planning a more traditional curatorial career?
I definitely was, because I didn't really know what the other options might be. I always envisioned myself at a major institution, you know, working in the halls of greatness at a major museum. In some ways, I still have that dream, but now I understand that there are lots of ways to be a curator, and there are lots of ways to talk about the arts.
In your wildest dream, what do you envision for the Project Room?
I would love to see the Project Room grow and develop into a really, into an established destination for people internationally, even if it's online or coming to the space, but a go-to place for people to say, that's where really interesting things are happening around creativity, and I want to be there.
Jess Van Nostrand's the founder of the Project Room on Seattle's Capitol Hill. Tonight at 6 o'clock, the creators of the show These Streets are going to be at the Project Room to talk about the idea behind the musical show and the many arms the project grew as they developed it. This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. Bet you can guess that's the sound of humpback whales nursing babies in an area between Maui, Lanai, and Molokai, Hawaii. Our listener Mike and his wife Pam went on a whale-watching trip in Hawaii yesterday. Lucky Mike and Pam. Mike dropped his hydrophone into the water for a few minutes and he recorded the sound. In addition to the humpbacks, you can even hear shrimp, he says, and possibly other cetaceans. The shrimp are a kind of popping sound. It's a great soundscape for this very rainy Thursday. Let's listen to that again. Boy, you're trying to figure out if the little high one is the baby after it has something to drink, but I'm not quite hearing the shrimp there. I guess I'll have to fly to Hawaii and check it out myself. Yeah, Bernard says, darn. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Maybe you're in Hawaii or maybe you're in North Bend. Record 30 seconds of a sound that you hear and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email it to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. And at least this one, we get to imagine we're somewhere sunny and lovely. Right, Bernard?
It's 9:59. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Among the news stories we're following today, Osama bin Laden's son-in-law and one-time spokesman has been captured overseas and is being brought to the United States, where he's expected to face trial in New York. That's in the news in a moment. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Fear of numbers, terror over arithmetic, apoplexy over algebra.
Some children are coming to school saying, I'm bad at math, before they've even stepped into a math classroom.
NYU's Dr. Rose Vukovich says math anxiety starts early because kids get the message that being bad at math is okay. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting comedian and actor Nick.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.